And so what I wanted to do was to kind of, rummage through the rubble of his life, right? To think with him about my own moment of despair and disillusionment, and to figure out how I could hold simultaneously my rage and my faith.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. The voice you just heard was Eddie Glaude, the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton. He's the author of a new book called Begin Again, about the writer James Baldwin, and how his work reflects on modern race relations in America. We've been spending much of our time recently on this podcast trying to explore Black life in America, especially in the South, in light of the seasons of changes and challenges in our country. We've already spoken to the poet Clint Smith and the hip-hop scholar Regina Bradley. Those episodes are available at wfae.org/southbound. And we'll continue to sit with guests to discuss the intersection of race, identity, and the South in upcoming episodes, frequently in the near future, and always as part of our mix over time. The roots of Black America and the roots of the conflict over Black Americans for our nation's entire history, those are grounded in the South. They're deep in our dirt. We intend to keep digging down. And so now, here's our conversation with Eddie Glaude. You wrote this book about how James Baldwin's work intersects with modern events. I guess before it came out, but after you were finished, all these things happened with George Floyd in Minneapolis. And suddenly, Baldwin's thoughts and his work seem even more relevant. And I'm wondering if you wished this had happened a little sooner, so it could have been a part of your book, or does it feel like the right time because now you can comment on it in the context of what Baldwin said?
In so many ways, Baldwin spoke to the American contradiction. And it's a contradiction that constitutes, in some ways, the through line of our history. So I think, speaking to a particular incident, in some ways, the book is prescient. In the sense that I didn't write it in the middle of what was going on in Minneapolis and the protest around George Floyd's public murder. But, Baldwin's words spoke and speak to it, nevertheless, So I don't know if I needed the specific incident to write about the state of the country in this moment. George Floyd's murder was like the spark that lit the candle. That dry wood, as it were. But Baldwin, because he's perhaps our most insightful critic of democracy and race, was already there, if that makes sense.
You talk about a scene where you had gone to Germany, you had gotten this award, and we're going to be spending some time at a university there. And just about the moment you get there, you're at a train station and you see four police officers. They're detaining a Black man. One of them has his knee on his back. And this was written, before George Floyd. And I'm wondering if you saw the sort of eerie similarities as it happened to the beginning of your book.
Well, the thing is that we had already come out of Ferguson in 2014. We had, seen and experienced so much of this horrible public ritual of Black grief and suffering around death at the hands of the police before the public murder of George Floyd. And, that's what makes the book so fascinating to me, is that here I am kind of responding to what I'm seeing because I've just come out of the U.S. and, as a commentator on television, having to talk about, Mike Brown to, Ayanna Jones. I mean, we could just go on and on and on, right? And then boom, I see it. And I see it and I hear it because it's a blood-curdling scream that the guy let loose. And so it just happened to be the case that, you know, the book was written and another incident, you know, another moment, another horrific death happened. That experience I had in Heidelberg, I suspect if I was to publish it 2 years from now, probably we would have another incident. You know what I mean, Tom?
I also wonder how that influenced part of your book that you get into later on, which is about this idea of elsewhere. Baldwin kind of famously went to Paris and then later to Istanbul to be able to see in his mind what was going on in America more clearly from a distance. And you talk about that too, and I think come to the conclusion that you don't have to leave to do these things. But I'm wondering whether that scene in Germany played into that conclusion that you came to, because maybe you felt like you couldn't escape it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's so insightful. Absolutely. You know, I mean, in one way, the book came together in that moment. I had been struggling. I hadn't put one sentence to the page about, you know, with the book at that point, right? So I'm in Heidelberg. I'm not in the country. I'm not in the city for an hour. And that's what I see. And I go back to my apartment and I just start writing. And that writing became the stuff of the introduction. But, you know, this elsewhere is this need for distance, trying to find the critical distance so that one could breathe and find the space to think about the country more critically. Many of us don't have the capacity to just pick up and leave. So what do? You have to find that distance, as I say, in communities of love, people who give you the space to laugh full belly laughs, people who allow you to rage. You have to find that moment by distancing yourself from the way in which power functions, right? So how do you identify with those who are fighting on the margins, and what kind of space and distance does that give you so that you can assess your own commitments, right? Trying to find that elsewhere so that you can exhale and then join the fight again.
Why did you think now was the right time to dig deep into his writing and his thoughts? How did they speak to you in the current moment?
Well, you know, personally, I was so angry, on the verge of despairing, as it, you know, on some level, with the election of Donald Trump in 2016. I was trying to figure out what was the language, the country, you know, what was the language I could use? The country had, you know, had done it again. Right? Here we are in this moment where we think that we have changed, right? We elect our first Black president, and people are saying that we've turned this corner, and what did we get? We got, you know, all of these voter ID laws and voter suppression, and we got the vitriol of the Tea Party, and then we elect Donald Trump. And in some ways we elected him to, and some, you know, people say that it was driven by economic anxiety, a desire to change Washington. But all of the social science research revealed, or, you know, kind of concluded, that what was driving this was deep racial anxiety. That the country was doubling down on its commitments to white supremacy once again. And I was just so frustrated, right? Here we are in this cycle again. And it led me to return to Baldwin, because I've been reading Baldwin and teaching him for close to 30 years. And I just remember the late Baldwin, the Baldwin who had to pick up the pieces after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who collapsed, who tried to commit suicide in 69, and had to retreat to Istanbul to figure out how to talk about this moment where at one point the country was on the precipice of profound change, and now they were on the road to electing Ronald Reagan, of all people, right? For Black activists, Reagan was as bad as George Wallace in some people's minds, right? That's hard for some people to think, to process, but that's true. And so what I wanted to do was to kind of, you know, rummage through the rubble of his life, right? To think with him about my own moment of despair and disillusionment, and to figure out how I could hold simultaneously my rage and my faith that we could be otherwise. And that's what produced the book. That's what I found in the rubble. I found Begin Again.
I hear novelists a lot of times talk about how they can almost literally feel their characters speaking to them as they write. Did you feel James Baldwin speaking to you at any point?
Oh, absolutely. It's always scary, you know? While I was writing Reverend Barbara, who's a great friend of mine, of the Poor People's Campaign, sent me a Saint's candle of Baldwin. I had one that I burned and I had one that I kept. There are these moments, right, that when I was trying to figure out, well, what's the hook? I would meet these people who knew him, who would reach out to me because they would see me on television. And they would say, oh, we should talk. And then I would meet them, and then they would give me these stories about Baldwin in this moment in his life. Or Carol Weinstein, who was Baldwin's brother David, David's partner, and the mother of David's son, Daniel, reached out to me, and that became an extraordinary friendship. She read every chapter of the book, gave me stuff from her own collection that no one had ever seen before. And then there was this one moment. This is the moment where I knew he was with me. The first biographer was Fern Marja Ekman, wrote an extraordinary book entitled The Furious Passage. Jimmy hated the book because she tried to psychoanalyze him. but the book is so rich because it's just full of quotations. She did about 40 taped interviews with him. And I was like, where are these tapes? I need to find these damn tapes. They weren't at the Schomburg. They weren't at the Smithsonian. Da, da, da. And my writing partner, my closest friend, is Imani Perry, who's my colleague at Princeton. And she said, well, why don't you call her? I said, well, Fern Marja Ekman has to be dead. She has to be about 100 plus years old. And then so she looked at me kind of okay. And then next thing you know, I get this email with all of these phone numbers. And it's from Imani. And so I call the first number. And Tommy, it was Fern Marja Ekman's house. And, you know, the healthcare worker answered the phone. English was kind of halting, told me to call back. I called back, said, okay, I'm going to give you the number to her niece. Her name is Leslie Freeman. I called Leslie. We have this amazing conversation together. Leslie's like, you do know I'm literally moving my aunt out of her apartment that she's lived in for 60 plus years, right? And then this week, I'm packing up everything. I said, wait, what are you packing up? And we get to talking, and I said, she invites me over to her apartment in the Upper West Side. I know this is a long story, but it's so important. And I go to the apartment, and I start looking at the collection, and I say to Leslie, stop, don't throw away another thing. This is because Fern Marja Ekman's this important woman reporter, right? And then she says, but Eddie, I don't have the tapes. I can't find them, but I have transcriptions. And lo and behold, there were five transcribed interviews. And I start reading them. And the only thing I could do is, oh, fuck. Excuse my own. Right? So there was, and I'm reading them and I'm going, oh, my God.
Basically what most white people think of as American history or the American story is based on what you call the lie, which encompasses several different things. Could you sort of explain how you see that?
Sure. So, you know, I think the through line of American history is what I've called in my other work, the value gap. And that is the belief that white people matter more than others. And, you know, it's like John Adams purportedly said to King George, we will not be your Negroes. At the very moment in which he was giving voice to an idea of freedom, it was based on a very intimate understanding of unfreedom. So this belief that white people matter more than others evidences itself in our practices. It shows up in our dispositions. It shapes our character. It is evidenced in our social, political, and economic arrangements. Well, how is the value gap sustained? How are those practices sustained over time? Well, we tell ourselves certain stories that justify them. We tell ourselves certain lies. And those lies are about the capacities of Black folk, about what we've done to Black folk, and they're lies about the reality that reveal what we've done and what we've said about Black folk. So there's this line, this paragraph in Baldwin's, one of Baldwin's essays entitled The White Problem. He wrote it in 1964, and he says, the people who settled the country had a fatal flaw. They could recognize a man when they saw one. They knew he wasn't anything else but a man. But since they were Christian, and since they had already decided that they came here to establish a free country, the only way to justify the role this chattel was playing in one's life was to say that he was not a man. For if he wasn't, then no crime had been committed. And then Baldwin says, that lie is the basis of our present trouble. So the lie is the story we tell about Black people's capacities, about our passions, about our way of being in the world. It is the story we tell to dehumanize Black folk, to justify our treatment. And then the lie that we tell about what we've done in the world, and then the lie to keep all of that reality in place. So, you know, I think, like, for example, to my mind, the lost cause, and I'm from Mississippi, the lost cause is a lie. It's not true. It never was, right? And so the statues in honor of all of these folk, right? I'm from Mississippi. I grew up in this really crazy way, idolizing Stonewall Jackson. Oh my God, what does that mean, you know? That these lies distort and disfigure our conceptions of democracy, right? And Baldwin wants to say that we need to be brutally honest with ourselves about what those lies have done.
I have to go back to the Stonewall Jackson part. You grew up in Moss Point, Mississippi. I want to find out what that life was like for you. Baldwin's visit to the South, certainly the one back in the 50s, and the things that he saw that dismayed him. And I was wondering how many bells that rang in your life and from your upbringing. But maybe just tell me a little bit about how you grew up and for one thing, how you came to admire Stonewall Jackson, at least in your early years.
You know, so, you know, one of the things that's so different between myself and Jimmy is that Jimmy is a child of Harlem. You know, he's a child of migration, right? His parents are both are migrants from the South, from Eastern Shore, Maryland, and from New Orleans. From Louisiana, right? So there's this there, but he's a child of migration. He's born in the South, in the North, and then he travels to the South and he's shocked. For me, the South comes to me like oxygen. It's the air I breathe. It has shaped everything about my sensibilities, how I see the world. And so I grew up in a small town on the coast of Mississippi. My dad, Vietnam vet, very intelligent, who took the post office exam after coming out and became the second African-American hired at the post office in Pascagoula, Mississippi. He knew he had precocious kids, so he moved us to the west side of town. And there I found myself growing up in a town that was predominantly Black, but I was in mostly white classes with two or three or four Black people, students in those classes. And I just remember in the eighth grade, Miss Mitchell, who I love and who I still love, who affirmed me every single day, teaching American history, teaching the Civil War. And, you know, I learned about, you know, the armament, right? Those the ironclad ships and how they were fighting, you know, the drama of the Civil War. And the way in which I remember and recall the war is Miss Mitchell teaching us that the South could have won if Stonewall hadn't been killed by his own men, right? And there's this story that she's telling because the character of Stonewall came through, you know, he was, bombastic. He was confident. He was brilliant. He was a genius. That's what she taught. That's how she taught it to me. Slavery, what the South was fighting for, footnote, right? I didn't feel alienated in that moment. And I love Miss Mitchell to this day, but I didn't feel alienated in the moment in which she was teaching about the Civil War. Can you imagine?
And when did things dawn on you that maybe it was different than what you were taught in school?
Oh, it started not soon afterwards. I'm a voracious reader. I remember getting my first job because I tried to get my mother to get me a summer job at the local shipyard. And she was like, no, you're not going to embarrass me. You're too lazy. She said, you were born to push a pencil. That's how she said it, right? Oh my God. You know, I come out of a working class family. My mother is, you know, these folk made me possible, right? And so I got a job as a page in a library, in Pascagoula Regional Library. where I was, you know, restocking, reshelving books and the like. And I came across the first edition of Manning Marable's, book Race, Rebellion, and Reconstruction. Right, it's this amazing volume on the what he called the Second Reconstruction. And I read it from cover to cover, and everything changed. I remember when I first got the checked out the album of Dr. King's Dream. I Have a Dream speech on, you know, that was the March on Washington album. I checked it out from the library, and I remember just playing Martin Luther King's Dream over and over again. I Have a Dream speech over and over again. I memorized it, and Miss Mitchell asked me to say it in class in the eighth grade. So that was a contradictory moment, but not soon afterwards. I began to find a language for my father's rage. Growing up in Jim Crow, Mississippi, you can't help but be angry in some ways. So the world began to impose itself upon me, and I needed language to describe it.
Hey, everybody. If I'm counting right, our family is in our 21st week of lockdown. You're probably in a similar place. In the midst of the pandemic, we've had a continuing national debate on race, equality, and policing. And oh, by the way, one of the most monumental elections in our nation's history is less than 100 days away. Our staff here at WFAE has worked through it all, bringing you the news you need day to day, the larger perspectives, and once in a while, an escape from it all. If you've been relying on us, please consider donating to us. It's easy. Just go to WFAE.com and mash the big red donate button. We appreciate all your support. And now, back to our conversation with Eddie Glaude. One thing that you come back to in this book several times is a story that I'm pretty familiar with, living in Charlotte and actually having written about some of this as well, is the story of Dorothy Counts, who was one of the four or five Black children who integrated the Charlotte schools in 1957. Her story was unique in that she was the only child that day in Charlotte to be the only Black child in her school. And as she went down the hill to the school, she was taunted by the white kids, but persevered for several days until the torment got to be too much and her parents pulled her out of school. James Baldwin saw photos of that when he was in Paris. And the story he always told was that that's what spurred him to come back to America, was saying he needed to be here to help her out and to support Black Americans in this moment. And the way you describe it in your book is that although the spirit might have been correct, he didn't quite have the timeline right.
No, he didn't. No, it couldn't have happened. He got his dates wrong. He was still in Paris. You know, at the time that he wrote about it, it hadn't happened yet, right? So, you know, in terms of how he dated it, it just doesn't map on. But what he's doing in the moment, though, and this is why it's so important. His misremembering of Dorothy Count, of what happened, is important to the overall structure of No Name in the Street in 1972. And this is the argument, right? So Baldwin, in 1972, he publishes No Name in the Street. And this book has given him hell, right? This is the first book that he writes after King's assassination. And there were a couple of interviews, one with Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, the other with Nikki Giovanni. He wrote a couple of journalistic pieces. But for the most part, Baldwin is trying to put himself back together, trying to find a form that responds to what has happened to the movement. And No Name in the Street is that book. And it's a book of trauma, of wound and pain. And that wound and trauma and pain is actually reflected in the very structure of the book. He actually says in the very beginning, don't trust what I'm saying. Don't trust my memories, right? My mind is strange, right? So there's a constant folding back on itself, mentioning a point and then returning to the past, a recounting. that he's telling you, that he's trying to give us an account of what happened, but he's also telling you not to trust it.
And regardless of the timeline, why do you think her story meant so much to him?
The power of those young students. Somebody should have been there with her, he says, right? Those improbable aristocrats, as he once described them. But what had happened since that moment? Dorothy Counts went through that, experienced it. And she was among a number of young people who risked everything to desegregate America's schools. And then Baldwin, writing from 72, what was he seeing? The country doubling down on its ugliness, right? The cruelty and sacrifice, what those babies, children now, had to go through, and how they would be irreparably marked by that experience. And look where we are now in 2020. Our schools are as segregated as they were when Dorothy Counts tried to desegregate them in some ways, right? Not quite as segregated as when Dorothy Counts tried, but definitely, right, as segregated as they were in the late 1960s.
There's a quote I wrote down, and I hate to say this, but I don't know whether it's you or him. I guess that's complimentary to both of you. But in the book, there's a mention of the fullness and sorrows of any human life overlaid with the constant weight of blackness. And I think that this is maybe something that in this current moment is beginning to seep into many white people's consciousness, that this is a reality, that there is a different life and a different weight on you if you grow up in this world black. But I guess the particular question I want to ask is, how has that weight affected you?
You know, I absolutely rejoice in my blackness. I'm from Mississippi. I'm from Moss Point. I grew up in a black Catholic church on fish fries on Fridays, listening to Al Green, Bobby Blue Bland, my favorite blues artist. Growing up fishing, you know, my daddy loved catching white trout. The culture in the barbershops, the full belly laughs, there's nothing wrong with being black. There's a lot wrong with racism, you know, as my colleague Imani Perry writes in The Atlantic. Baldwin put it like this in The Uses of the Blues, that whatever the Negro problem is, it is this: trying to keep what the world says about us from taking root in our souls. Trying to keep our children from believing what the world says about them. Trying to keep them from committing themselves to the idea that they're less valued than others. You know, having to deal with the daily cuts. We're engaged as parents in daily triage, trying to make sure our babies are okay. Right. And, you know, you don't have to, you know, I have a 24-year-old and I still worry about him. Not because as a parent, you worry about your child until they put you in the ground, but because you don't know what will happen. Every time he goes out, every time he leaves, you know, you worry about him because you don't know what some policeman or somebody's going to do because of the color of his skin. Right. And, you know, there are elements of our lives that are all that evidence themselves in that way, whether it's trying to get a mortgage, whether it's trying to get a car loan, whether it's trying to get a job, whether it's trying to raise your baby, whether it's trying, you know, that this black tax that has nothing to do with us, has nothing to do with me. Right. And this is Baldwin's insight. I'm not the N-word. I've never been the N-word. The question is, why did you need the N-word? Why did you need the N-word in the first place? And until you answer that question, we're going to be right here, you know? So what is this effect? I love being black. Never doubted it. But the anger and the rage of a world organized in such a way that devalues the fact that I'm black. My Lord.
I think the way that Baldwin also frames it, and I think you as well, is that there's nothing necessarily irredeemable about white people either. And that it's all based on a unwillingness to admit what you framed as the lie. And I think it's not just a social political thing. I think it's framed in the book as moral terms, the moral effects of a way of life emptied of genuine meaning because of a lie that denies the things we've done. My question is, why have so many people clung to it?
We think the very idea of who we are will collapse if we don't cling to it. The idea of America as the shining city on the hill, the idea of America as an example of democracy achieved, right? This idea of America as, right, a moral exemplar in the world, if we give that up by confronting our ghastly failures, so many white Americans believe they give up the cornerstone of their identities. Now, I believe, and I write this in the book, that the idea of white America is irredeemable. But that doesn't mean we are. Now, what do I mean? The idea of white America is predicated upon the value gap. That is predicated upon the belief that some people, because of their color of their skin, should be valued more than others. That idea is irredeemable. There's nothing about it that can be salvaged. But that doesn't mean that we are irredeemable, that we can't figure out a different way of being together with each other, right? That we can't figure out a way of organizing our social lives, our political lives, our economic lives in a way that doesn't presume that because of the color of your skin, that somehow you are less than. And so, you know, Baldwin makes this distinction in The Evidence of Things Not Seen, published in 1987, the year he died, that there's a difference between white people and those who happen to be white. And he says, those who happen to be white, and this is how I parse it, those who happen to be white are those who are engaged in what, you know, Wendell Berry, that Kentucky bred white boy, you know, said in The Hidden Wound, that he's constantly interrogating the way racism comes to him like language. He learned it like at his mother's knee. And so there's this ongoing kind of effort to understand himself in the fullness of what it means to be a human being in relationship to others, but understanding how fallen and finite and fragile he is, right? In relation to the languages that come to him. But then there are white people. And white people are folks who are invested in the value gap. They're the ones who believe that this world should be organized in such a way that if you're white, you should be valued differently than others. So I make that distinction because I happen to love a lot of people who happen to be white, and then they're white people.
And you say in the book that the way to improve the world, I guess is a very short way of putting it, is to make that those beliefs of those white people, to basically give them no room to breathe in the society. How does that happen?
Well, part of this is, you know, that formulation comes out of my reading of history. You know, C. Van Woodward in The Strange Career of Jim Crow talks about the reconciliation of the North and the South and how that happened on the backs of black folk. And every moment in which the country kind of compromises with those who hold racist, noxious views, we have to bear the burden of it. We have to bear the brunt of the compromise. And another generation has to kind of struggle to keep its head above water. And so there's only a finite amount of civic energy, you know? We only have a finite amount of civic energy. We can only do so much in the short time we have between womb and tomb. And so we spend so much energy trying to convince people who hold absolutely insidious views about my value and worth that then we don't fight for the kind of world that we ought to be fighting for. So I'm not interested any longer in trying to convince someone who believes that I'm worthless, that I'm less than, that I'm valued less than they are, that they shouldn't hold that view. Instead, I want to build a more just world where those views have no quarter to breathe. Now, what would that look like? That would look like building an education system that no matter where you're, what your zip code, what color you're in, that you're getting, what color you are, that you're getting a high quality education. That's a commitment that the country has never made, ever. Right, that no matter your zip code, no matter your color, no matter your economic standing, that you can get, you can acquire, you know, the tools to see the world in all of its grandness. I want to hold a view that, you know, we can build neighborhoods, cities, we can pass zoning laws that will change the way in which we live our lives because, you know, we're walking mysteries to each other. I grew up in Moss Point. I was, you know, I was in predominantly white classes, probably one of the more integrated kids in the town. But our town, man, the railroad tracks, Doc. You're from the South. You know what I mean?
Yes.
We're mysteries to each other outside of work and outside of restaurants, right? Outside of entertainment spaces. We don't exist. I work in the highest, at the highest levels of American education. But when I leave Princeton University, I go into a basically segregated world, right? So I believe that we can build a world that we can be together differently if we just put our energy there. And then you don't, there's no advantage if you hold noxious views.
One thing I want to come back to here toward the end is that Baldwin has this continual image that's through all his work and becomes the title of your book about new beginnings, about rebirths. He talks about the New Jerusalem, all these different beginnings. And he always talks about now's the time to start over, now's the time to begin again. Does this moment we're in, does this feel like a new beginning to you?
Feels like an opportunity, you know? But we're already hearing the, you know, clamorings for the lie. As people double down on the Confederate flags and the Confederate statues, rather, as Tom Cotton declares that slavery was a necessary evil. I don't know what that means in its detail. We already hear the clamoring for the old ways, as it were. But we're at a moment, it's a moral reckoning. You know, in the blues, it's a crossroads, right? Where we have to choose. Our history doesn't suggest that we're going to choose well, but we're here. You know, Baldwin, you know, he talks about begin again, but he also in his later years would invoke Revelations, the second chapter of Revelations, verse 5, right, where he wants us to do our first works over, right, where we have to tell the story of how we've gotten to now, which will release us into a different way of being in the world, you know. So we have an opportunity. And, you know, I'm of the mindset, Tommy, that wherever human beings are, we have a chance. But we have to realize that human beings are both miracles and disasters at the same time. So there's no guarantee of the outcome. It just depends on what we do.
James Baldwin wrote with fury, but he also wrote with love. Deep down, he believed that we could make a more perfect union in this country if we approached our problems, especially our biggest problem, with honesty and care. Any reasonable view of American history might argue otherwise. White Americans have held the power in this country from the get-go, and you can read our history as the unrelenting desire to never give it up. But that gap between what is and what ought to be, that's the definition of hope. It's a credit to James Baldwin and Eddie Glaude that they still think there's a way to bridge that gap. But it takes a lot more than belief to build a bridge. At some point, everybody's got to pitch in and do the work. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.